The test is in four parts, part 1, part 2, part 3, and part 4. Now look at part 1.
Part 1.
You will hear a telephone conversation between a client who wants to rent short-term accommodation and a rental agent. First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 5. Now, we shall begin. You should answer the questions as you listen, because you will not hear the recording a second time. Listen carefully and answer questions 1 to 5. Good morning. Ace Accommodation. How can I help you?
Good morning. I'd like to organise some short-stay accommodation on the Gold Coast, please.
Certainly. Who am I speaking to?
Miss McKinley. Sylvia McKinley.
Could you spell your family name for me, please?
It's M-A-C-K-I-N-L-A-Y.
Thank you. And your first name is Sylvia?
Yes.
Is that with an I or a Y?
A Y, the old-fashioned way. That's S-Y-L-V-I-A.
Thank you, Miss McKinley. Now, just for our records, can you tell me what country you live in?
Of course. It's England, actually.
I thought so. Now, when are you coming?
Well, at the moment, we're planning on arriving on July the 26th.
Oh, the 25th. That's the last day of the public holiday, and it might be difficult to find something available on that date.
No, we're coming on the 26th of July.
Oh. Well, that's fine then. We'll have lots of good places vacant by then, although you wouldn't be able to move in until late afternoon, because our cleaning crew will need time to get everything ready for you.
That suits us. Our flight won't get in until early evening anyway.
How many of you will there be?
Just my sister and myself.
And how long do you intend to stay for?
Oh, only a couple of weeks. We'd like to stay longer, but we'll have to get back to work.
So, you're not coming on business then?
No, it's just a holiday. Why, what difference does that make?
Oh, you'd be surprised. Business people have different needs. You know, wireless internet, even fax machines and photocopiers.
No, we won't need any of that stuff. We'll be coming to relax and get away from all that kind of thing.
Before you hear the rest of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 6 to 10. Now listen and answer questions 6 to 10. Good. Now, what exactly are you looking for? A house, a duplex, or an apartment?
What's a duplex?
Oh, that's what you might call a townhouse or a unit. You know, two houses semi-detached on the same property.
Oh, I see. I think an apartment will suit us just fine.
And how many bedrooms? Two.
One or two, it depends on the size. My sister and I don't mind sharing if it's a decent-sized bedroom with two beds.
Well, that makes it easier. And car parking? Will you require a lock-up garage? They're a little harder to find with an apartment.
We'll have a hire car, and as far as I know, there are no regulations concerning car parking. I think as long as it's not parked on the street and it's secure, there shouldn't be any problems.
Okay. Now, I'm assuming you want something by the beach.
Yes, that's the idea. We want to enjoy the surf, sand and sunshine.
Okay, but before we settle on an area and discuss your price range, I'll need to know about other necessities.
What do you mean?
Well, for example, do you want to be close to a shopping mall or the casino or the fun parks? Or do you want to be in a complex with or near a swimming pool?
No, none of that really matters to us. But we'd like to have reasonable access to the motorway so that we can drive up to Brisbane to visit friends there.
Well, there are quite a few lovely small towns to choose from. There's Main Beach, which is north of Surfers Paradise, or Mermaid Waters, which is a bit further south, or Palm Beach, which is quite a bit further south.
Mermaid Waters sounds delightful. Is it close to the motorway?
Well, not really. The M1 is actually closest to Palm Beach, and prices are likely to be more reasonable there too.
That's settled then. Palm Beach it is.
Now, if you'll just give me your email address, I can send you information about the town and lots of photos.
Well, my email is smac13@hotmail.com.
And one final thing. How much are you looking to spend per week on accommodation? Do you want something at the luxury end of the market? You know, newly redecorated, great views, all the mod cons?
Not necessarily. Could we get something clean, comfortable and reasonable for $1,200 a week?
Could you stretch that to $1,500 a week? I've got a property in mind that you'll absolutely love, but you'd have to go to $1,500. $1,200 wouldn't cover it.
All right then, but that's our top limit.
Good. I'll get on to this straight away, and there should be something in your inbox shortly.
That is the end of part one.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part two.
Part two.
You will hear a conversation between a travel agent and a customer.
First, you have some time to look at questions 11 to 17. Now, listen carefully and answer questions 11 to 17.
Good morning. Can I help you?
Yes, I'd like to get some information about trips to New Zealand.
Certainly. Take a seat and I'll be right with you.
Thanks.
Now, where would you like to go in New Zealand?
Well, I was hoping to do a bit of travelling around, actually. There are a few things I'd like to see and do before I go back home.
Right.
One thing I really want to do is go to Christchurch. I have relatives living there that I can stay with, my mother's cousin, and I've heard it's a nice place.
Yes, it's a lovely city, and staying with relatives will help with the budget, of course.
The budget?
It will save you some money.
Oh, right. Well, I'm not too worried about that. I've saved quite a bit of money working in Australia.
Oh, that's nice. Good for you. Well, you know that New Zealand consists of two main islands, the North Island and the South Island, and Christchurch is on the South Island.
Is it? I was never very good at geography at school. Do you have a map I could look at?
Sure. Here we are.
Right, I see. And... well, then I'd also like to spend some time in Auckland, and maybe I could do an English language course there. Can you organise that sort of thing for me?
Oh, certainly. We'd be happy to arrange that. But bear in mind that Auckland is in the North Island.
Okay. And I'd also like to do some skiing or maybe even some snowboarding. I hear New Zealand is a great place for that.
Yes, absolutely. But you should go to Auckland first for your studies, and then you can get the ferry across to the South Island and take the bus down to the snow.
Oh, I don't like boats very much. I'm not much of a sailor. I think I prefer to fly.
Right. What about joining a walking tour? That could be really fun.
Not sure about walking, but joining a tour might be a good way to travel because then I might make some friends my own age.
Now, let's get some details. Can I have your name, please?
Yes, it's Su Ming Lee, but you can call me Sue.
Okay, Sue. And what's your address here in Melbourne?
I'm living with my aunt in the suburb of Kew. It's 29 Locke Street. That's L-O-C-H, not L-O-C-K.
Do you have a phone number that I can get you on?
The best thing would be if I give you my mobile. I always have it on me. It's 0402-558-992.
Okay. And when do you want to travel? Because you'll need to be down south in July or August.
Oh, yes, of course. That's winter, isn't it? So I'd better go to Auckland in May.
Yes, let's say departing from Melbourne on the 1st of May. That's a Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could begin your course on Monday the 3rd.
That sounds great.
And how long would you like to study for? A month, two, three? What do you think?
Well, I'll probably need more than a month. What about 8 weeks until the end of June?
Fine. I'll see what I can do. Oh, and how would you like to pay for this?
On my Visa card, if that's possible.
Before you hear the rest of the talk, you have some time to look at questions 18 to 20. Now listen and answer questions 18 to 20.
Hello, Sue. It's Angelo from Cosmos Travel here. I've booked your flight and I've found you an English college called the Harbour Language Centre.
Great. Where exactly is that?
Well, have you got that little map I gave you yesterday?
Yes.
You see where the harbour is with the three wharves and the water?
Yes. Got that?
Okay, there are two parallel streets. Key Street, that's Quay, and Customs Street. The building where the college is located is on Key Street, opposite Prince's Wharf.
Right, got it. And what about accommodation?
Well, I've booked you into a hotel for the first 3 nights, and then the accommodation officer will find you a family to live with.
Good. And where's the hotel?
It's a short walk from the college, on the corner of Queen Street and City Road.
Which corner exactly?
On the left-hand side, as we're looking at the map.
Okay, near the little park.
Yes, that's right.
And what about a good bookshop? I'm going to need to buy a dictionary and some English books.
Yes, well, I believe there's a really good language bookshop on the corner of Customs Street and Queen Street. It's near the college, so that's pretty convenient.
Thank you so much. You've been really helpful.
That is the end of part two.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part three.
Part three.
You will hear two university students discussing their course and a project they are doing together. First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 25. Now listen to the first part of the conversation and answer questions 21 to 25.
Hi, Martin.
Hi, Kate. How are you?
Fine. I'm relieved to have done my presentation.
I'm sure. How did it go?
Oh, okay in the end, but I was ever so nervous beforehand. It's silly because I do know my stuff quite well. I must know those statistics inside out. But when you have to get each table of results to come up in the right order, it can make you nervous.
Mm.
It was my first time using the computerized projector, and I was sure I was going to get the controls wrong or something. And, of course, that's not a good situation if you know you've got to listen to questions carefully and be ready to answer quickly.
But it was fine once you got going?
Yes.
I do feel that the standard of presentations could be improved in general. I think a lot of the lecturers agree with me, although I don't honestly know what they can be expected to do about it. Students need to appreciate the difference between style and content. Too many presentations are just a mass of detailed content, all very worthy, without any attempt to engage people's interest. Basic things like looking at your audience's faces seem to get forgotten. And that makes it harder to concentrate on the points made about the research itself.
Yes, there are quite a few improvements I'd like to see. Take tutorials, for example. I feel they're often a missed opportunity. I come out not feeling sure about what I've learnt. Week in, week out, I faithfully plough through the reading list, which is fair enough, but then the discussion doesn't seem to extract the main issues. It's frustrating.
I know what you mean. Mind you, we have to take some responsibility ourselves. I actually got quite a lot from that skills workshop I went to on taking notes, and I'd like to make similar improvements in the next semester. The reading list we get has several websites each time, and I want to learn to navigate my way round them more effectively.
Now that sounds a good idea. Mind you, it means spending more time in the library.
If you can get in.
You mean because it's too crowded? It isn't big enough, is it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I like to work late in the evening and it shuts before I want to finish. But I know you can access the catalogue from a laptop.
Which, personally, I haven't got. Actually, the problem for me is that I like to get up early and start work straight away, and they don't start until 9. I wish they'd change that.
Now you have some time to look at questions 26 to 30. Now listen to the rest of the conversation and answer questions 26 to 30.
Look, we ought to start working out what to do next for our project.
Yes, enough moaning.
Okay, the main thing is to allocate the various tasks between us, isn't it?
Yes, well, we're going to need the questionnaire before we can do much else, aren't we? Do you want to handle that?
I'd assumed we'd do it together.
Well, you have more experience than me. Maybe you could think up the main questions, you know, a first version of the whole thing, and then I could read it through.
And make suggestions. Well, okay. My experience on projects has all been with closed groups. I don't really know how you go about selecting subjects from larger populations.
Actually, it's quite straightforward. You use tables of randomised numbers.
Could you show me?
Yeah, I'll take you through the process. That way you'll learn and I'll feel surer for having someone else there. Now that brings us to the interviews themselves.
Right. Would you like to do them, or are there too many?
Well, your typing's pretty fast, isn't it? So if you agree to handle the transcribing afterwards, I'm prepared to do the face-to-face stage.
Does that sound fair?
It does to me. But tell me if you find it takes longer than you thought.
And vice versa. And when we get the results all together, they'll need to be run through statistics programs, won't they? Well, that's where I always feel a bit unsure about which tests are the correct ones to choose.
Same here. But we can get advice from the lecturers about that. Shall we do all that as a joint effort?
I think it'd make us feel more secure about what we were doing.
Yes, it would be terrible to get that wrong after all the hard work leading up to it.
And then we've got to present the whole thing to the group. Will you feel up to doing that?
I think we should do a joint presentation. It's all both our work, after all.
I guess you're right. But would you mind getting the slides and so on ready? I find that takes me ages and still doesn't look any good.
Whereas I quite enjoy that kind of thing. OK. Now, we need to think about a few...
That is the end of part 3.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now it turns to part 4.
Part 4.
You will hear a woman giving a lecture about the positive effects of laughter. First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 40. Listen carefully to the lecture and answer questions 31 to 40.
Good morning, everyone. I do hope you didn't get too wet getting here this morning. The subject for my talk, I think we could all do with some to take our minds off this atrocious weather, is laughter. The laughter I want to look at is specifically related to psychological therapy and the treatment of physiological disorders, something we've been looking at over the last week or so. Now, when we start talking about psychological therapy, laughter isn't something that immediately springs to mind. Therapy is a serious business, and it's generally approached with an appropriate degree of seriousness. After all, people seek treatment and enter therapy for serious reasons. They're often at critical junctures in their lives, and they need professional help. The question is, how is it that laughter can be such a vital part of the therapy process? It's normally identified with humour, and thus generally deemed appropriate only in lighter, more frivolous circumstances, when it's acceptable to find a situation funny. Perhaps this is why so many people in the medical world feel that laughter's frequently misunderstood and undervalued as a cathartic, healing process. Now, humour certainly is one trigger for laughter, but it isn't the only trigger. If we take as a starting point the fact that laughter is a physical process that releases emotional pain, it follows that stress, anxiety, and tension may prompt the same response. Psychologists frequently point out that humans don't laugh because they're happy. They're happy because they laugh. Once we accept that laughter and pain are related, we are less likely to be shocked when people laugh in all sorts of painful, even tragic situations. Cathartic psychotherapy utilizes laughter as an essential medium for healing emotional pain. It's specific to the release of anger, fear, and boredom. When people laugh, they free themselves of painful feelings. The amount of pain the body releases during a single burst of laughter is immeasurable. But we know that the body will keep discharging pain cathartically until there's no longer a need. The only obstacle to the process is the self-constraint we learn to impose on ourselves during our early years. We're taught the virtues of self-control from infancy, and any loss of that control during an emotional outpouring is discomforting. We fail to realize that when we lose control, we actually gain in many other ways. Our cultural preference for processing feelings cognitively, instead of feeling them physically, maintains and prolongs emotional distress. Patients who have had upbringings during which feelings were suppressed may have quashed their ability to laugh, cry, and become angry. Clinicians can help individuals regain these cathartic processes, enabling them to release deep-rooted emotions that may be an obstacle to happiness. Only now has research begun to validate the notion that emotions are stored in the body rather than the mind. Recently developed cathartic techniques allow practitioners to teach patients how to access their hidden emotions and release them. The more catharsis the patient experiences, the more rapidly he or she progresses through the healing process. Laughter is probably the least threatening cathartic process, at least to the person expressing the laughter, and so it has an essential role. It's often a stepping stone to other forms of emotional release, like crying or showing rage. So why, you might ask, has the mental health community been so slow to accept laughter as a healing tool? Well, for reasons I've already outlined. Like any expression of the true self, laughter is radical and revolutionary, and laughing at what is seemingly misfortune upsets conformity. We in the medical professions must challenge the antiquated view that adult laughter is silly and inappropriate. We have to ensure that patients don't reject the healing power of their laughter in the fear that others will see them as making light of their issues. Traditionally, mental health practitioners have viewed laughter as a way of hiding painful emotion. In contrast, cathartic psychotherapy understands that laughter releases emotion. Through laughter, feelings erupt from within into the outside world. If people suppress laughter, they also stifle the release of pain. The catharsis of laughter doesn't change people's circumstances, but it does change the way people relate to those circumstances. It enables them to take a different view, a view from which terrible misfortune can seem so much more bearable. This allows people to remember, to feel, and to explore without fearing that they'll be trapped by what they can't control. Life's most tragic events often have an essence of absurdity, and this can be the trigger point for laughter. Some people deal with emotional pain instinctively and come along to therapy already laughing and crying. There are many others, however, that need assistance.
That is the end of part four.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.